live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. This is a continuation of our series on conversations with remarkable minds. The topic, the masters of wealth and their history of influence over this nation. My guest from the Bay Area of California is Danny Sheehan. Danny is one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. For nearly 50 years, a half a century, he has handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, and Karen Silkwood's murder case. He has represented victims of the Three Mile nuclear disaster, and he fought against the American Nazi Party on hate crimes. He is the founder of the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute. And Danny has a law degree from Harvard University. He later returned to Harvard, to its Harvard Divinity School. He is the author of The People's Advocate. His websites are Danny P. Sheehan, that's SHEEHAN.com, and RomeroInstitute.org. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Terrific, Gary. I'm glad to be here.
Since 9/11 and again after 2008, with the economic meltdown, we've witnessed how the federal government and Wall Street and much of the private major international corporations have grabbed enormous control over the nation and the people's lives. Some think of this in terms of conspiracy theories, but after 9/11, as well as 2008, we witness clearly there is nothing artificial about this control. It is not a mere theory. People are coming together and they're asking, how did all this transfer of power and wealth into so few hands happen? Where is the transparency? And for probably the last 35 years, there has been a small fringe group of individuals who've said, well, look at the banking community. Look at the banksters. Others have said, well, there are secret or private groups out there like the Council on Foreign Relations with more than 5,000 members who hold undue influence over foreign policies, and yet they're not elected, and yet they have the power to cause legislation to be impacted. You have think tanks, thousands of think tanks and NGOs that have enormous influence. They all are staffed with people with outstanding pedigrees, the finest universities. And these people come forth with long resumes, frequently in public service as well as in the private sector, and they hold forth as the experts. They know best. And then there are those who say, well, where do we, the people, stand? And I believe that the people do not stand for anything today except being a commodity, and as a result, they have relinquished so much power, even unintentionally and without understanding how these powerful cabals directly influence their lives and policies at the national level, and how the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, does it by writing bills that become laws, over 25,000 over the last 30 years, that no one knew about. We all thought that our state legislators were doing our work, the people's work. They were not. And so in we come to you. I want you to share with us in detail everything that we can in this hour. There'll be no interruptions, no commercials. We're non-commercial. Where you can explain how it started, how it in with people who are alive now, people who were part of this relatively small group, who they are, how they came together, and how they created one of the most powerful, influential groups in history. Most of their names are not known. A few are. But when you look at who they are and what they caused, people will be shocked. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you, Gary. This has actually been a fairly long journey for me to kind of peel this onion one layer at a time. I came into it early on when I was at Harvard Law School, but I'd come up, as you'd mentioned, from Harvard College. When I got into Harvard College, and I was in GovOne 86, it was taught by Henry Kissinger, and Henry Kissinger started the class right out with all. I was in the last all male class at Harvard. I graduated in 1967, and that when we went into GovOne 82, and it was that Kissinger just announced us right at the beginning of the class with all the men sitting there who were waiting to help run the world, telling us that, look, if you think that our government doesn't have the right to lie, steal, cheat, and to kill in order to forward the best interests of the country itself in the world, then you shouldn't be in this course. And I was one of the few public school kids, kind of working class kids that were there. And here are all the fellows from prep schools and, you know, all the finest families around. They were all sitting there nodding, yes. And I started saying to myself, wait a second, you know, who does he think he's talking to here? And, you know, he told us one time about, for example, that there was a provision in the United Nations Charter, the Uniting for Peace Resolution. He said that where any country that's a member of the United Nations in the General Assembly, if they can get two-thirds of the other members to vote for them and take up an issue under this Uniting for Peace Resolution, they can override any veto on the part of the five major nations that are in charge of the Security Council. And he said, if the people of the world ever find out about this, we're in trouble. And so I said to myself, who's we, white man? So I began right at the time when I was there at Harvard College trying to kind of learn how it is the people there thought, what it is they expected to be able to run the world, et cetera. And I ended up going up to Harvard Law School and studying there and co-founded the Harvard Civil Rights Law Review with Mark Green, who went on later to be the nominee of the Democratic Party for the United States Senate in New York and was the nominee for mayor one time. But he and I co-founded the Harvard Civil Rights Law Review in 1968. And it was there that I sent out letters to lawyers all around the country saying, look, if you have a major significant constitutional law question involved in a case that you're doing, please write to us here at the Harvard Civil Rights Law Review, and that we'll become involved in helping you work on that. That's how I ended up representing the first of all, I was contacted by a young lawyer in Boston, John Flynn, who went on to teach law at Harvard or at Northeastern University Law School. And we had an instance there where it turns out that the Boston police, every single time that any young black man had robbed a store or anything in the city, they would put out an all points bulletin looking for a young black man, you know, about 5'10" to 6 foot tall, you know, between, you know, 17 and 30, who was the suspect. And then the Boston police would go around arresting every single young man who was in town, handing out copies of the Black Panther newspaper because the police hated them. And so they'd round them all up and bring them in and put them in lineups all day, hoping that someone would misidentify them as the culprit in some crime. And then when it came time in the morning to have to bring them in front of a magistrate to show probable cause as to why they'd arrested them, they would turn them loose. And they just happened to have lost all of their copies of the Black Panther newspaper that the police impounded. So John Flynn didn't know what to do. He was contacted. So I put together the complaint, filing a major federal civil rights suit against the Boston Police Department, charging them with racial and political discrimination, and got a federal injunction against them doing that. And because of that, it turns out when the riots happened, Following Martin Luther King's assassination in April of 1968, I was there at Harvard Law School, and it turns out the police in New Bedford, Massachusetts, had been given orders to shoot on sight any looters during the riots that followed there out in New Bedford. And the Black Panther Party had barricaded the roads, the streets leading into the ghetto area to keep the police out. And a reporter, an NBC television reporter, was invited into their headquarters to take an interview from them. And he entered into an agreement whereby he agreed to keep confidential all of the stuff that was told to him that wasn't put on the air in his piece for NBC. And what happened is the district attorney subpoenaed him and demanded to have all the outtakes of his videos and to tell everything that he'd seen and who he saw inside the headquarters and what, because they were, the district attorney was trying to charge the Black Panther Party with instigating the riots in New Bedford. And so he went to the NBC lawyers and tried to get them to protect him, to keep him from having to give up the information that he had gotten from confidential sources during his interviews, etc. The NBC television lawyers wouldn't protect him. They went to the national office of the Cahill Gordon law firm in New York on Wall Street, who represents NBC. They wouldn't protect him. So he ended up calling the Black Panthers and saying, look, I don't want to reveal the information I agreed to keep confidential, but I need some help. And they said, oh, look, there were some young lawyers in Boston that just this year, you know, filed a lawsuit against the Boston Police Department, and they won this big injunction. Why don't you contact them? And so they ended up calling John Flynn. He called me, and we put together the case that ended up establishing the right of journalists to protect their confidential news sources, going all the way to the United States Supreme Court.
Danny, that gets us into a little background on you. But you have so much knowledge. I want to focus, if you would please, on the most powerful group probably in American history, starting with the Dulles brothers and the banking firm, the law firm that very few people today, unless they're an older lawyer, would have heard of.
Sullivan and Cromwell. Yes, that's right.
So tell us about those people and what they personally were responsible for.
Well, that's how I got there, because it turns out that because of my doing that particular lawsuit, I ended up getting recruited right out of Harvard Law School by Cahill Gordon, Sonnet, Rindell, and Ohl, which was the number one litigation corporate law firm in the world on Wall Street. And so I got invited right into the inner sanctum because they represented NBC News. And when the case got all the way to the United States Supreme Court, the big law firm that had refused to help the reporter, Pappas, John Pappas, they hired me right out of Harvard Law School because he wouldn't allow them to represent him. And so that's how I ended up at the big law firm, and that's how I got to get on the inside. I was there when the Pentagon Papers began, so I got to see the all 47 volumes of the Pentagon Papers. I started saying, wait a second, it looks like there's a whole other world going on here behind the scenes, that there are people making decisions and calling the shots that aren't publicly known at all. And so I began to examine and study that entire network of people, because I discovered in the confidential portions of the Pentagon Papers that there was a massive heroin smuggling operation going on out of Southeast Asia that was actually providing money that was being used by the American Central Intelligence Agency to fund criminal covert operations around the world. And so I started asking myself, wait a second, who's in charge of this thing? Because it didn't appear that individual presidents had control over this. It didn't appear that any of the Congress had control over this. Who are the people that are in charge of this thing? And so that's how I focused in on looking at the Covert Operations Directorate of the Central Intelligence Agency and tracked it all the way back to Alan Dulles. I mean, Alan Dulles was made the first civilian head of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1953, right after Eisenhower and Nixon were elected. And I began to examine what the conduct was of those people. And this now, of course, is well before the impaneling of the Church Committee, Senator Frank Church from Idaho that chaired the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Abuse. It was well before the impaneling of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the Pike Committee, all those people. So I was there sort of early on inquiring into this entire realm when the Watergate burglary took place. And I got recruited from the Cahill firm by F. Lee Bailey to come and work there at the firm and work on the Watergate burglary. And that's how I discovered that the people that were inside the Watergate Hotel worked with the Central Intelligence Agency, had worked under Alan Dulles, had been deeply involved in political assassinations. So I continued to delve into this entire area. And I discovered, track it all the way back, and I realized that it would appear that when Alan Dulles became the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, he brought with him these extraordinarily powerful connections that he had, that he was the legal counsel for Brown Brothers Harriman, which was this private investment firm that had begun back in early 1880s, and it was still it became a major source of power, secret power in the United States, because the people that were the private investment clients for Brown Brothers Harriman included people like John D. Rockefeller and later David Rockefeller, E.H. Harriman, the magnate that owned tons of railroads and stuff, and the Rockefellers owned not only Standard Oil of New Jersey and Standard Oil of California, but they also owned the Chase Manhattan Bank, and the DuPonts were there, Irene DuPont. There were about a dozen or so major magnates that were all clients of Brown Brothers Harriman, and they would sit together in council and in their offices at Brown Brothers Harriman and make joint decisions as to where they were going to invest, that they were going to all become members of boards of directors of these interlocking directorates, etc. And I realized, I tracked it back and discovered that these people had designed a brand new business vehicle shortly after the American Civil War, which was the new stockholder corporation, and that they transformed the ancient idea of a corporation, of individual people coming together and functioning as a unit with the permission of a government for some narrow single purpose, like building a canal or building a postal road or doing one of those things, that after the American Civil War, they transformed the American corporation into a business device that actually immunized the people who actually owned the stock in the company. So they effectively owned all the resources and assets and a share of the profits, but they were completely legally immunized against any personal liability for anything the corporate vehicle did. And the management of the corporation was completely immunized, so that the only thing that was liable were the resources that were actually in the bank of the corporation at the time they were ever sued. So these men had devised a special vehicle, the major stockholder corporation at the end of the Civil War, which in a short 30-year period between 1868, at the end of the American Civil War, up to 1898, a simple 30-year period, these people rose to such extraordinary levels of power in the United States by forming interlocking directorates among themselves and all meeting in conference with each other in the offices of Brown Brothers Harriman in New York. And Brown Brothers Harriman, as an investment firm, was represented by the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, right there in New York, just a block and a half away from the offices of Brown Brothers Harriman. And it turns out that the individuals who were the private investment clients of Brown Brothers Harriman were also individually represented by the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. And so that there was this lock that occurred between these private investors, and they rose to as many as a couple dozen of these major tycoons that sat in these meetings and had the same lawyers, and their CEO, the chief executive officer of Brown Brothers Harriman, was George Herbert Walker. who was the grandfather of George Herbert Walker Bush. And he brought in his son-in-law. George Herbert Walker's son-in-law was Prescott Bush, who was the father of George Herbert Walker Bush, and the grandfather of George W. Bush. So this was this cabal of people that rose to power actually in that 30-year period between 1868 to 1898. Those men brought in their sons, not always their eldest son by the simple rule of primogeniture, but their most powerful and aggressive son, sometimes a second son or even a third son, and that they formed a major cabal that actually sat behind the scenes and would pull the levers of government. They would bribe members of the House of Representatives. They would bribe senators. They would decide who the presidents were going to be. For example, Mark Hanna in 1898 was a huge multimillionaire from Ohio that owned coal mines and steel mines, or steel companies and stuff. And he basically handpicked McKinley to be the president of the United States and put him into office, and was then appointed to fill the U.S. senator's position in Ohio, because he handpicked the U.S. senator in Ohio to become the Secretary of the Treasury. And that this operation was going on, this shift of power from the fathers, who were these original tycoons, to their sons, and then to their sons, and that this crowd would, and most of them ended up sending their sons to be trained to Yale University or to Harvard or to Princeton, and they would be trained there. And these are the people that were making these extraordinary sets of decisions. And what I discovered was is that the reason that Alan Dulles was made the head of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1953 by Dwight D. Eisenhower and Richard Nixon was because he was the lawyer for these people. He was the legal counsel from Sullivan and Cromwell, a senior partner that was assigned to be the lawyer for Brown Brothers Harriman. And that was the source of his power. And so when he came on, and it turns out, when I further investigated it, it turns out that the Central Intelligence Agency itself was created at the direct recommendation of a man by the name of Robert Lovett, who was also a senior partner at Brown Brothers Harriman. And he was put in charge of a commission to decide whether or not the United States should have some type of a covert operations agency after World War II. And he is the one who recommended creating the Central Intelligence Agency. And I discovered that other wealthy, powerful people who were close personal friends, his assistant, for example, Robert Lovett's assistant, was a man by the name of William D. Pauley. William D. Pauley is a guy that chaired another commission called the Doolittle Commission, which said that the United States has to develop a covert operations capacity that is more ruthless and vicious than anything that our enemies might do. And that, therefore, all of the rules, there are no rules in this game, he said. And therefore, the American concept, traditional concept of fair play, has to be revisited. And that we have to be able to do conduct that is more vicious and more effective than anything applied against us. And he said that there may come a point in time when the American people need to be informed about what we're doing. But in any event, no one can be allowed to stand in the way of the effectuation of our mission. And that was the Doolittle Report that was written by William D. Pauley. And it turns out that William D. Pauley, as I said, was an assistant secretary of defense under Robert Lovett, who was a senior partner at Brown Brothers Harriman. And it turns out that I later on found out that Robert Lovett was a person, one of the three trustees, along with a guy by the name of Robert B. Anderson, also a senior partner at Brown Brothers Harriman, and a guy by the name of John J. McCloy, who was also an attorney, that they were made trustees of a $1.2 trillion super secret trust that was assembled by gold and silver and platinum and jewels that had been recovered in the Philippines at the end of the Second World War. that it turns out that a major unit of the Japanese military had been tasked from Japan from 1930 all the way to 1941 with raiding gold and silver and platinum and jewels all throughout Southeast Asia and bringing it to Japan. And when Japan feared that the United States was going to be invading Japan at the end of World War II, they secretly smuggled all of this gold and silver and platinum and jewels out of Japan, buried them in 175 troves deep in the hills of in different places in the Philippines. And the head of intelligence for the U.S. Army in the Philippines, the G2, as they called him, whose name was Edward Lansdale, found out about this, and he tortured the driver of the General Yakushima, who was in charge of that unit that buried all of that, and recovered 12 of those 175 troves. And it turns out that there was $100 billion in each one of those troves. So they ended up having 12 of them for a total of $1.2 trillion, and they set up a private, not a public, the Congress never found out about it, nobody was told about it in the government agencies, and they set up a private trust of $1.2 trillion that was supervised by Robert Lovett, a senior partner of Brown Brothers Harriman, Robert B. Anderson, another senior partner of Brown Brothers Harriman, and John J. McCloy. And this group was functioning as the control behind they issued gold certificates predicated upon this wealth that they had, and they shipped it out of the Philippines and put it into secret accounts in Switzerland. And they issue gold certificates, and they use the gold certificates to finance the putting into power of fascists at the end of World War II, because they were afraid that the people that were part of the resistance to the Germans and the Nazis all during World War II, the partisans, these men were afraid that they were potential socialists and that they were going to be opposing the reinstitution of the fascist government. And then I continued the investigation, and I discovered, it turns out, lo and behold, these people at Brown Brothers Harriman had actually financed the rise of the Third Reich in Nazi Germany. That between World War I and World War II, they had actually, there was this extraordinary set of things that I began to discover. And one of them was that at the end of World War I, at the Versailles Treaty negotiations, the Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, under Woodrow Wilson in 1918, it turns out he married the oldest daughter of John W. Foster, who was the grandfather of Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles. And John W. Foster had been the Secretary of State back in 1890s under Harriman, and he's the one that fostered and promoted the taking over of the Philippine Islands. It fostered the overtaking of Hawaii and Guam, and had then started setting up the program for taking over Cuba in the Spanish-American War. He was a major strident imperialist who, at the crescendo of the robber baron era in 1898, that this whole group of people had arisen to the ascendancy where they were in charge of American foreign policy, and they were promulgating a major imperial set of policies, sending U.S. military expeditions into South America, overthrowing elected governments in Panama, overthrowing the government in Nicaragua, all on behalf, in that case, of United Fruit. And it turns out United Fruit was a client of Brown Brothers Harriman. And it turns out that Cromwell, of Sullivan and Cromwell, is the lawyer who, in fact, had secured Panama, had overthrown the government in Panama in order to put the canal through. Now, this cabal of people, you say to yourself, holy mackerel, how could anybody not have known about this, of what was going on? Well, it turns out that people did know. virtually everybody that was in the professional governing circles in the United States knew about this operation, and they would go to them, and they would request their assistance, would offer them positions as Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of the Defense, offering them positions, high positions in the government, so that they could establish partnerships with these people. And therefore, nobody challenged the behind-the-scenes power that these people exercised. But when they got to the point of, even when they discovered that they were funding the rise of Hitler, it turns out George Herbert Walker, the CEO of Brown Brothers Harriman, he left Brown Brothers Harriman in 1924 and turned over the CEO position to his son-in-law, Prescott Bush. And then George Herbert Walker went on and founded the Union Bank of New York. And he got private investment clients from Brown Brothers Harriman to deposit huge amounts of money into the Union Bank of New York. And then he set up a subsidiary of the Union Bank of New York up in the Netherlands, the Bank of Shipping and Commerce. And there was a fellow by the name of Fritz Thyssen who was put in charge of that. And this is the bank that funded Adolf Hitler in the rise of Hitler to the power in Europe, to try to establish them as a bulwark against Bolshevism. Because this group of investors and stuff in Brown Brothers Harriman and Sullivan and Cromwell, they were so freaked out at the end of World War One when the Bolsheviks overthrew Tsar Nicholas and established the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, that they actually insisted on a U.S. military expeditionary force being sent into Russia to try to crush the Bolshevik Revolution. And there's almost nothing taught about that in any of the high schools or colleges. But in fact, it took place in 1918 under the Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, who was the uncle of John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles, who were partners in the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. So this operation was the thing that's so important about this particular congregation of men is that it's so obvious what they did, and they even to the point of funding Adolf Hitler. There, in fact, there was a meeting on January 3rd of 1933 in which a decision was made that Adolf Hitler was going to become the Chancellor of Germany, and sitting in that meeting was John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles. And all they said, they insisted that Hitler, as a condition of them agreeing to have him be made the Chancellor of Germany, that he just had to agree to pay the war reparations that Germany was determined to have owed to the Allies because of their aggressive war launched in World War One. And as soon as Hitler agreed to take those debts on and agree to pay those, they gave the green light for him becoming the Chancellor of Germany. And it turns out, lo and behold, that those reparations provisions in the Treaty of Versailles in 1918 had been drafted by Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles as the nephews of Robert Lansing, the Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, who brought his two nephews to the Versailles Treaty negotiations in 1918 and put them in charge of actually drafting into the Treaty of Versailles the requirement that the German government pay reparations to the companies whose property they had damaged in World War One. And it turns out that then the attorney for Germany in negotiating the repayment of those loans turned out to be Allen Dulles. He not only drafted the war reparations requirements, he was then made the lawyer for Germany, and he negotiated getting the clients from Brown Brothers Harriman to give the loans to Germany with which they paid off the war reparations that had been inserted into the Versailles Treaty by Allen Dulles. And the payments that were going to be paid for the reparations were in part going to corporations that were clients of Brown Brothers Harriman. And so what they did is they were sending billions of dollars in these loans to the German government, and they were using them to rebuild their military and build up their industry and reestablish their business cartels. And they were all doing this under the leadership of Allen Dulles. And that's why Allen Dulles had such a close relationship with the fascists and John J. McCloy, who was the third of the trustees that I mentioned, that was one of the trustees of this Anderson Trust at the end of World War II of the $1.2 trillion, John J. McCloy, the only one who was not a senior partner in Brown Brothers Harriman, he actually, we have photographs of him in the 1934 Olympics sitting in the private box with Adolf Hitler. Overseeing the Olympic Games in 1934. So it turns out that these people were, that it dawned on me, and I'll tell you exactly how the incident that caused it to dawn on me. When we filed the Iran-Contra case in May of 1986, and I filed it in the federal court down in Miami, when I came back to my office from that, I ended up being contacted by a guy who said, look, there's someone who wants to talk to you about this case that you've just filed. And he brings me over to the Dubliner restaurant in Washington, D.C., right at the bottom of Capitol Hill. It turns out this man is Joseph Burkholder Smith. He was the deputy CIA station chief in Mexico City in 1973, which was like 13 years earlier. And he told me, but in 1973, he was told that the new head of Western Hemisphere operations for the Central Intelligence Agency, a man by the name of Theodore G. Shockley, was coming on to be the director of Western Hemisphere Affairs, and he was removing all of the chiefs of station of all of the CIA stations all through the Western Hemisphere, because he said that there's somebody that's going to be writing a book about the CIA, which was going to be inside the company, and that he was afraid that they might have known the names of the chiefs of station. So he removed them all and appointed his own people to be in charge of each of the stations in the Western Hemisphere, and he assigned a man by the name of Tom Polgar to become the chief of station in Mexico City, where Joseph Burkholder Smith was. And Tom Polgar says to Joseph Burkholder Smith, he said, look, Joe, I'm not sure I'm going to keep you on here as my deputy, but there's going to be somebody coming in tomorrow morning to your office at about 10 o'clock. You'll recognize who he is, and he's going to ask you some questions. And depending upon how you answer those questions, that'll determine whether I'm going to keep you on here as my deputy. And he said he may even want you to go and meet some other people, and they may have some questions for you. You don't have to answer them, but if you choose to, it may help determine whether you're going to be left on here as my deputy station chief. And so the next morning into his office walks Nasser Haro, who is the head of the DFS in Mexico, which is like the combined FBI and CIA. And he brings him in, he walks in, and he tells Joseph Burkholder Smith, there's some people who want to talk with you to determine whether you're going to be left on as the deputy CIA station chief in Mexico City here in 1973. And so he takes him downstairs. They drive away in this smoke-windowed Suburban, and they bring him to the airport in Mexico City. They get into they go all around security, and they get into this Learjet or private jet, and they fly and fly away, and they end up landing in Buenos Aires, and they get out and get into a helicopter, and they fly north, way up to the northern border of Argentina. They land in this little town called Salta on this soccer field. And he gets out, and he follows Nasser Haro across the field, and he walks up this embankment, and he looks down, and he said to me, here, I'm sitting here talking to him at the Dubliner Cafe. This is 1986, in June, first week of June in 1986. And he said, you know, I followed Nasser Haro across this soccer field, and I walked up this embankment, and I looked down. Here I am in Salta, in the northern tip of Argentina. And he said, I looked down to this town. I thought I was in Bavaria, he said. And he marks, picks him up and walks down into the town, and they go to this little Bavarian inn, and he walks in, and here are these six men sitting at this big oaken table in front of this big stone fireplace, and on the mantelpiece over the fireplace is a huge swastika flag, a regular full-scale, you know, Nazi flag. And he's kind of astonished, and he sits down at the table, and they say, the man at the center says, look, Joe, he said that we need to know if you're left on. We need to tell you that we have set up a major cocaine cartel here in South America, and a portion of the profits that are going to be generated by the sale of cocaine up in the United States are going to be used to help fund our war without boundaries against your enemies and ours. And we need to know that if you're going to be left on, as the deputy CIA station chief in Mexico City, you're not going to do anything to interfere with that. And Joseph Burkholder Smith said to me, sitting there in the Dubliner Cafe, there in the first week of June of 1986, he said, "And Dan, I swear to God," he said, "I don't know anything that I had done that would have given them the idea that I would have gone along with that." And I said to him, "Well, how about being the deputy chief of station at the CIA in Mexico City for a start?" And he said, he got up and he looked over at Dick Billings, who brought me over to see him. And he said, "Gee, I thought this fellow was going to cooperate with us." And Billings said, "Look, I just met the guy." And so Joseph Burkholder Smith gets up and walks around the table, sticks his hand out to me, and I stick my hand up and shake his hand, and he looks me in the eyes, and he said, "I just wanted to make sure that if you were going to start a case like this, you knew who you were really dealing with." Okay? And that was the moment. It turns out these people that we're talking about are fascists. They're not just conservatives, Republican conservatives. They're not just even very conservative. They're fascists. They actually believe in the very form of government that was established by Adolf Hitler in the Third Reich as the bulwark against Bolshevism. The direct alliance between the corporations, this new business vehicle that was created by this group of people at the end of the American Civil War, and the alliance between them and the government, and that the government, well, actually, the legislators that are paid for by these corporations, that are bribed by these corporations, will in fact pass laws that protect them, and that they will actually give subsidies of tax money from the government to the corporations to subsidize their research and development with regard to not only weapons for the military, so that they can project their military power out into the world to garner privileged access to the strategic raw materials that are viewed to be needed by these American corporations to produce their profits for their stockholders, but that in fact they will pass legislation giving the power of the corporations to actually be just like people. In fact, they will appoint their lawyers, and they did back in the 1880s. They started appointing their railroad lawyers, their oil company lawyers. They started getting them appointed to federal judgeships, and the ruling was actually made back shortly after 1868 that for the first time the United States Supreme Court ruled that corporations are people. It wasn't just most recently in the Citizens United. Yes, Citizens United. It wasn't just, that's not the first time they've made that ruling. They made such a ruling back in the 1870s.
Danny, I just need you're giving us a phenomenally detailed account, but I'd like you to make, if you have this information.
Yes.
I cannot imagine that these individuals that you're talking about in the late 50s and 60s were not also aware of John F. Kennedy, who they, I believe, thought would be one of them. After all, his father was one of them.
Yep.
And was with Meyer Lansky. His father, Joseph Kennedy, was partnered with Meyer Lansky and the original organized crime family in New York. He supplied a lot of the trucks and the booze out of Canada, et cetera.
Yeah.
But then Kennedy had an about face and became a completely different person and unacceptable to them, in my opinion.
That's right.
But I don't have the proof. Do you have any proof that these people were responsible for the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
Yes. I'll tell you exactly what it was. Is that I was contacted. The man who came to see me at my office right after we filed the Iran-Contra case on May 28th of 1986, the man I was just telling you about, Dick Billings, who brought me to meet Joseph Burkholder Smith, he in fact sat down and told me, it turns out he was the chief of staff and the chief writer of the House Select Committee on Assassinations that reinvestigated the Kennedy assassination following the Church Committee hearings and following the Warren Commission. That they're the ones that did the investigation. And he sat down and told me that it turns out he, back in 1963, was the Miami bureau chief for Life magazine. And in that context, he had been invited to go on a mission to Cuba and he determined that it was an assassination trip to go and try to assassinate Fidel Castro. And he was flown in a PBY out of the right by Southern Air Transport in the Miami airport, and on the night of June 18th of 1963, he was flown with a team of men who all gathered there under the command of a man by the name of William Rip Robertson. And William Rip Robertson was in command of this 10-man unit, all made up of right-wing anti-Castro Cuban exiles. And they were flown in this PBY from the Miami airport down off the coast of Cuba. They landed on the water. There's PBYs and those big flying boats. They got out and they got in. They boarded the yacht of William D. Pauley, a yacht called the Flying Dutchman, or excuse me, the Flying Tiger, Flying Tiger II. And they got on board and they brought the team to send them ashore to try to assassinate Fidel Castro. And they pulled up, and where they were waiting for the return of this team that they sent ashore in a boat, and they went out to this place called Hognose Reef, and they anchored the yacht, the Flying Tiger, on the backside of the reef to wait for them. And during the nighttime, they were actually shooting sharks in the water and drinking Schenley's, or drinking Jack Daniels, he said, and they started getting a little drunk. And one of the guys there, John Martino, who was a mob guy, a Santos Trafficante mob family guy on board, was ranting about Kennedy and what an SOB he was and how he betrayed them after the Cuban Missile Crisis and had ordered them to shut down all their paramilitary bases that were operating against Cuba. So he was ranting and calling him a dirty SOB. And William D. Pauley, who was the commander of the ship on which the assassination team was taken ashore, he stood right there and said, "Don't worry, John. We're going to kill that MF." That's what he said to him, right there. I mean, and Rip Robertson was standing right next to him when William Pauley said that. And Dick Billings stood there and kind of was aghast at what he had said. And it turns out that we have the photographs now that Dick Billings got for us, the photographs of Rip Robertson standing right on the street corner, the northern curb of Elm Street, right next to the famous Simmons freeway sign, that when Zapruder was standing up on the parapets filming the actual assassination, when President Kennedy's limousine went behind the Simmons freeway sign, remember, he came out from behind the sign holding onto his throat. He'd been shot already. And standing right next to the Simmons freeway sign is William Rip Robertson. And there's no way in the world that the field commander of the assassination team that was put together to kill Fidel Castro would possibly have been standing there next to that sign on a full 10-mile parade route that goes from Love Field to where Kennedy was going to be going to do his afternoon luncheon speech. He was standing there, and we've got photographs of Edward Lansdale standing there in about 3 minutes later. There's Edward Lansdale standing in Dealey Plaza. Now, there's no possible way that that happened, and Dick Billings happened to know both of these guys because Dick Billings had met William Rip Robertson on board the Flying Tiger in June of 1963, had gone and played golf with him, had gone duck hunting with him. He knew him intimately, and he knew that he was the head of an assassination team. And then I personally was told directly through my chief investigator, by Santos Trafficante, the head of the mafia in Cuba, when I got recruited by F. Lee Bailey out of the Cahill firm I mentioned, during the Watergate burglary case. And when we discovered that Gonzalez and Martinez and Bernard Barker, who were three of the four guys that were caught, the three guys that were caught with James McCord inside the Watergate Hotel on June 17th, 1972, that when we found out that these guys worked for Santos Trafficante, F. Lee Bailey, turns out, was the attorney for Santos Trafficante. You know, it wasn't the other people who pretended to be his attorney publicly were not his real attorney. It turns out that F. Lee Bailey was the attorney for Santos Trafficante because F. Lee Bailey was on a secret list called the Index 4 of four major lawyers in the United States that are picked by the CIA to defend any CIA agent who is caught engaged in an unlawful covert operation inside the United States, which is totally forbidden by the National Security Act in 1947. And so Bailey was the lawyer for Trafficante, and Trafficante told my chief investigator, Andrew J. Tooney, told him in detail when Bailey sent him to talk to Trafficante to find out what the hell are your people doing in the Watergate Hotel, bugging the telephones of Larry O'Brien. And it turned out that's how we found out that Richard Nixon had personally instructed Jeb Magruder to have Hunt and the other guys go into the Watergate Hotel to wiretap the telephones of Larry O'Brien, because Larry O'Brien, immediately prior to his becoming the head of the Democratic National Committee, had for 20 years been the chief lobbyist in Washington, D.C. for Howard Hughes. And Howard Hughes is the guy that Richard Nixon contacted and asked him to set up the assassination team to kill Castro. And it was that unit. And Santos Trafficante told us in May of 1973, long before there was any church committee, long before there was any House Select Committee on assassinations, in May of 1973, told us that it was that S-Force of anti-Castro Miami-based Cubans who had assassinated President Kennedy. And he knew these people because he's the one that handpicked them to be on the team to assassinate Castro. So he knew exactly who they were, and he told us that these are the guys that did it. And it was David Morales, who was one of the shooters, Rafael Chichi Quintero, Ricardo Chavez, and a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez. So we know who they were because he told us who they were. And then we've got the photograph of William Rip Robertson standing right on the street, right on the curb, you know, tipping his hat, literally tipping his hat to the president as the president's car goes past the Simmons freeway sign, and tipped his hat to the president 1.2 seconds prior to the shot that was fired that hit the president, the first one. And that's the guy who's the field commander for the S-Force, the assassination team. And so that we get this direct confirmation, not only from the photographs, but from what we've been told earlier by Santos Trafficante, and it's Alan Dulles. They said there is the one that commanded those people. And it wasn't because Alan Dulles had been fired by John Kennedy, which he had, after the Bay of Pigs fiasco in April of 1961. Kennedy sort of smoothly had him depart by October of 1961 and replaced him. But it wasn't because Dulles was upset about that, or even the fact that Kennedy was threatening after the Bay of Pigs fiasco to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and cast it to the winds. It wasn't that. It was Dulles in his capacity as the consigliere for the people at Brown Brothers Harriman and Sullivan and Cromwell, that cabal, that group of people. But I want to make clear, though, however, is that these people, when we discover this and go, holy mackerel, look, there's this horrible nest of these vipers that are sitting there as the investment clients of Brown Brothers Harriman and Sullivan and Cromwell, and it turns out these are even the people that instigated an attempted military coup against Franklin Roosevelt back in 1934. The commandant of the United States Marine Corps, General Butler, you know, blew the whistle on these people and actually went before the United States Congress behind closed doors and named who they were, and nobody did anything to them. They just sort of slapped their knuckles and told them to stop doing that. And the same thing happened again when they rose to power, and we found out that they were funding the rise of the Third Reich. When they got caught doing that, there was testimony provided behind closed doors again to the United States Congress, and they wrapped their knuckles and told them that they had to stop doing that because now the war was on. And they were still funding the German state, even though they were at war with us. And then when they stopped doing it, the Congress said, look, you've got to divest your ownership in the corporations inside Germany. And they hired a lawyer to keep from having to do that, and they hired Alan Dulles from Sullivan and Cromwell, who protected their continued ownership of those stocks and those companies in Germany. And so that this group, you want to say to yourself, oh no, this has got to be some unique event in American history that took place during this particular period between 1868 and 1898, and then from 1898 into the early 20th century when this unique group of people existed in this coven of a group. Well, it turns out that it's not true. It turns out that there's an old famous Irish aphorism that I should tell you about, that the Irish refer to Ireland as the old sod. The old sod, they refer to Ireland. And there's this Irish aphorism that says, ah, well, the old sod, it isn't what it used to be, but then it never was. And that's what people need to understand, that a cabal like this has existed inside the United States government and in parallel to the United States government in the private financial community ever since the founding of the country. Alexander Hamilton was the lawyer for a whole group of private investors and mercantilists and bankers, et cetera, back in the founding of the American Constitution in 1789. That he is the one that countered Jefferson and Madison and Aaron Burr and the guys who wanted to have a democratic government where everybody was equally represented and it was one person, one vote, and they had constitutional rights that were protected by the federal government. So it was Alexander Hamilton as the consigliere for this group of private investors who said, no, 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 we don't want the people to be allowed to elect the president. What we're going to do is have electors selected. And the electors of the president were selected by the state legislatures, not by the people at all. And the state legislatures are the ones that selected the United States senators. And there were a whole series of these compromises that were put into the structure of the original Constitution, and that they were all choreographed by Alexander Hamilton as the consigliere for the mercantilists and the bankers back at that time.
Danny, just hold your thoughts. We have stations all across the United States that are going to have to say goodbye now because we've reached our 55 minutes of our program. However, because of the significance of what you're saying, because we have not heard this before, I'm going to ask you if you would please to stay on for an additional, let's say, 10 minutes, maximum
sure.
15. I'm going to apologize in advance to Utrice Lead. But, Utrice, this is actually historic because I still have three questions that I'm going to ask Danny in a moment concerning 9/11, if he knows anything about that, concerning the Vietnam War, and concerning the current presidential debates, because you're talking about Alexander Hamilton and selecting delegates that would then select
yes.
the people instead of the people. Well, we've got superdelegates, and we have a completely corrupt political process today. I want to see if the same people are behind this and some of the names of companies that they would recognize.
Mm-hmm.
So to all of our other stations, thank you for listening. You can continue to go to the archives and hear the rest of the program that you're going to miss now. And I thank you. Now let's continue. Danny, if you could do the following, if you could address the
yes.
following issues succinctly. One, no lone person could have assassinated the President of the United States and have covered it up. To have done this, you would have had to have had a lot of people in important positions who would have been guaranteeing
mm-hmm.
that a commission like the Warren
right.
Commission would never come to the decisions that would have implicate
right.
the true people, just like the 9/11 Commission was completely
yep.
fraught with fraud.
Yeah.
Even we're told that by people who sat on the commission, including the former head of the commission.
That's right.
We also would want to know if you could just name us the people involved that you're aware of directly with the Kennedy assassination who would have had to have been a part of that, or it would have been not possible for them to have gone forward because of the FBI investigation under Hoover, who was later
That's
replaced,
right.
and others. Tell us who was involved so we can get a better grip on
right.
who these people were in the Kennedy assassination.
All right. The people that were directly involved, first at the logistical operational level, was William Rip Robertson, Grayson Lynch, his immediate deputy, Rafael Chichi Quintero, Ricardo Chavez, Rolando Martinez, David Morales, and, of course, Edward Lansdale. And they had to be given consent to do this by Bill Harvey, who was the head of operations at the CIA station in Miami, and the fellow by the name of Theodore Shackley. Theodore G. Shackley was the chief of station of the Miami station in November of 1963. And then up above him, obviously, Alan Dulles. And Alan Dulles had been in Dallas in the first week of November, meeting with people there. And J. Edgar Hoover knew about this as well. And what we know is that after the assassination took place, Lyndon Johnson went to Earl Warren, who was the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court at the time, and pleaded with Earl Warren to head up the commission that was going to be investigating the assassination. And Earl Warren said he didn't think it was appropriate for a Chief Justice to be involved in a criminal investigation like that. And he said that he declined. And then Lyndon Johnson told him, look, Earl, I've got to tell you something. Look, the president was assassinated by a, that he said that there was an assassination team that was fielded to assassinate Fidel Castro. And it appears that this group may have assassinated the president. And this assassination team was put together by John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. And if, in fact, the word gets out that such an assassination team was targeting Fidel Castro, people are going to suspect that Fidel Castro found out about this and retaliated against him and killed the president, and then everybody's going to be up in arms and insist we invade Cuba, and we're going to be back into a Cuban Missile Crisis and a Third World War. He knew about the assassination team. He told Earl Warren, and he said, well, the thing, you've got to come on and chair this commission in order to conceal the existence of this assassination team. You've got to conceal that. So we won't have a Third World War. And it turns out it was a complete lie that these people were created. This team was created by Bobby Kennedy and John Kennedy. Total lie. They were created by Richard Nixon back in June and July of 1960. We know the full details of it because Trafficante told us about it.
Oh, so, hold on 1 second. Danny, one thing. I want to make sure I'm not missing something. So mm-hmm. You're telling us now that the real reason for the Watergate break-in was because Richard Nixon was afraid that the new head of the Republican National Committee, National Committee, who had worked for Howard Hughes for 20 years, and Howard Hughes and Nixon together were the ones who sponsored the original assassination group of, 15 people?
15
men. And that those 15 men were there to assassinate not just Fidel Castro, but others, the other Castro brothers, and any other political people they wanted to. And
that's
he
right.
was afraid that this guy might say something that would jeopardize Nixon's reelection bid.
In 72,
and
that's exactly right.
And that they actually went in once and planted the bugs, but then found out a bug didn't work, so they had to go back in and rebug the place.
That's
and it was
what
the
they were
second
doing
one.
On June 17th. That's right.
Is my assumption correct there?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what happened. And that's exactly what Trafficante told us about. And Trafficante knew the full details about it. And he told us all the details about it, including, interestingly, he told us, and this is extraordinary, he told us about the conversation that Richard Nixon had had with Bob Haldeman on June 21st, the so-called smoking gun conversation, where Bob Haldeman comes into the office and says to Nixon, he says, Mr. President, I think we got a problem here. John Dean, the White House counsel for the president, just received a call from Pat Gray, the new head of the FBI, and he's being pressured by people inside the FBI to investigate the check that was found in the pocket of Bernard Barker, one of the burglars. And it was written on a bank down in Mexico City, the Banco Internacional. And he's being pressured to go down there tomorrow and investigate that bank account to find out what that's all about. And Pat Gray wanted to know whether that's going to cause any trouble for the White House. And then Nixon says to Bob Haldeman, Bob, I want you to go and get John Ehrlichman and you go over to the agency and you meet with Dick Helms and Vernon Walters and you tell them to get in touch with the FBI right away and tell them to stay out of that part of this investigation. And then Bob Haldeman says to him, well, what am I going to tell them to say? And Nixon says, you tell them that if they don't get out of that part of the investigation, all the Mexico stuff about the Bay of Pigs guys could possibly come out. And Bob Haldeman says to him, well, will they know what that means? He says, oh, yes, they'll know what that means. And when Bob Haldeman was asked on the witness stand in the Watergate hearings by Sam Ervin of North Carolina, he said, well, what did that mean? And Bob Haldeman says, I believe they were talking about the assassination of President Kennedy. And there was a complete dead silence for like 20 seconds in the room. Now, and Trafficante had told us about that conversation, and that Nixon had personally tried to stop this thing, and the agency was stopping this. So we knew about that. So Trafficante knew about this. So when Trafficante told us what had happened, he tried to convince us that the S-Force themselves had made the decision to kill the president, and they'd gone ahead and killed him because they were furious that he had ordered the shutdown of the five paramilitary bases in the southeast United States after the Cuban Missile Crisis. But that's not true. They never in the world could they have gotten away with that. They had to have been given the green light by people above them, including Richard Bissell, another guy that would have had to have known about this. And so the key to understand is that Alan Dulles, in the decision being made to kill the president, he was going to go to the people. He was going to go to the people whose power he represented to cover his back. And so he virtually certainly talked with the key members of these 50 to 60 men who were, in fact, the private investment clients of Brown Brothers Harriman, who were his clients. And he told them that this event was getting ready to happen and to make sure that they consented and gave the green light for this thing to happen. And that's the power behind the throne. That's the group of people that were going to participate in making sure this thing stayed completely concealed. So they had access to Lyndon Johnson. They had access to J. Edgar Hoover. They had access to and there isn't any question about it that the FBI, within a matter of 4 days, had insisted that Lee Harvey Oswald is the only one who was involved in this, and that he was a deranged individual lone gunman, and that was the story. In the Warren Commission, you can tell, from if you read through the multiple volumes of the Warren Commission report, you can tell from the examinations of the witnesses that the lawyers for the commission are insisting, from a prosecutorial point of view, to ignore every single piece of evidence except what they can hammer together to try to indicate that Lee Harvey Oswald did this act all by himself. And on the other side, the people who are some of the quote conspiracy theorists, they keep saying, oh, poor Oswald was a completely innocent guy. He was just a poor patsy, an innocent guy that was confused. And that's not true at all. I mean, Lee Harvey Oswald was an operative, not for the FBI, not for the CIA. He was working for a group called the Foreign Intelligence Digest. It's a specific group that was funded by H.L. Hunt and William Pauley and a guy by the name of Charles Willoughby, who was the G2 for Douglas MacArthur in the Pacific. So we know who these people are, and the people in the know who these people are. And so the question is, what's going to be done about this? And so that you see in this election right now, the difference between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton is that Hillary Clinton knows enough to be afraid of these people. She knows enough to be afraid of these people. She knows enough to take their money. She knows enough to take care of their interests. She knows that you cannot cross these people without deadly results. Bernie Sanders doesn't know that. Bernie thinks that you can just speak up on behalf of the American ideals. You can speak up on behalf of the values that are publicly promulgated as representing our country. And the fact of the matter is that that's never been true. That ever since the founding of the country, there's been this dark side of the United States. And the people all around the world know it, except for people in the United States who sit there and are just spoon-fed this pablum by the major networks and now by CNN and the other cable stations. They're just kind of fed this story.
Danny,
what our situation is
okay,
now.
Okay, I don't have time at this moment because your tree lead is following us, but I'd like to ask you just to give us a 60-second statement on this. Do you believe that these people were behind this kind of group or behind 9/11?
Yeah, I believe Theodore Shackley was the guy behind it. Theodore Shackley was the head of covert operations for the Central Intelligence Agency under George H.W. Bush. And he was the Miami station chief in Miami. He was the head of the Western Hemisphere operations that ran the overthrow of Allende. He was, in fact, the direct deputy to Reinhard Gehlen, the head of the Waffen-SS Nazi anti-Soviet intelligence organization. He's the guy. He's the guy that is the nexus between the American governmental officials and the fascist network all around the country and the world that are rooted down in South America, in Argentina and Brazil. He's the guy. And this is a classic Shackley operation, of having Operation Able Danger, a readiness exercise going on right that day, pretending to go through a readiness exercise of what if two major airliners struck the trade towers in New York and it was a terrorist attack. What are we going to do about that? And right at the very time that that was going on, they had instigated the people in Osama bin Laden's team to try to pretend that they were going to try to do this. They weren't capable of doing something like that, but they thought they could be, and so they undertake an effort to try to do something like that, and what happens is they magnify the consequences of their action, and behind the scenes, unknown to them, exactly what happened with Oswald. They tricked Oswald into thinking he was going to be participating in a pretended almost a successful assassination attempt against Kennedy, so then they could in fact instigate the invasion of Cuba. So he ends up participating in it, but what lo and behold, it turned out to be a real assassination operation, and they killed him right in front of him. And so he started freaking out. That's what happened here, and the same thing happened in 9/11, I believe. Is that they tricked the Osama bin Laden's people into trying to attack the trade towers, which they'd attacked once before. But the fact is they clearly had explosive devices planted all through the buildings. We know that now. There's empirical evidence to establish that. And it turns out that the chief of security for the trade towers was the cousin of the Bushes. He was in charge of it. And they shut down the whole trade towers 2 weeks earlier for a whole weekend because they had safety inspections in the building. And now this is something that sits as a major cancer at the center of the body politic of the United States, this 9/11 event and the Kennedy event. And the solution to it has to be found.
Danny, we're going to invite you back because there's a whole lot of space between the 1960s when the Dulles brothers were running CIA and the State Department. We want to bring you back to talk about those corporations that all those people owned and owned stock in and how they've morphed over the years and where they're at today. That'll be our next discussion.
I appreciate it.
Danny Sheehan, S-H-E-E-H-A-N. He was the lawyer with the Pentagon Papers, the Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, Silkwood, and many others, Three Mile Island. And he's sharing stuff today that we did not know. And we thank him very much for that. He's the author of The People's Advocate. His website is danielpsheehan.com or romeroinstitute.org. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening to this extended edition.